Hello, I'm David Bird. I'm a partner in Wynn Mitchell, a firm of solicitors. And in this webinar, we'll be discussing inheritance tax and trusts in 2018. So it will appeal to you if you are involved in estate planning for individuals and inheritance tax planning, or if you are involved in trust administration, tax calculations for trusts. I hope you enjoy the webinar. What we're not going to be talking about is detailed inheritance tax computations, so it's more a discussion of the principles involved. So the webinar is going to take into account the law as at today's date, of course. So first things first, what is a trust or a settlement? And those two expressions are used interchangeably. They effectively mean the same thing. So a settlement is any disposition by any person, so the property is held for persons in succession, so which would mean one person A is entitled to the income for a period of time, and after that person has died, or if that interest ceases, another person B becomes entitled, so their successive interests. We've then got for a person subject to a contingency, and this is quite commonly seen where a gift is made into trust for a child on reaching age, let's say 25. So, or if they have to get married first or some other contingency. Then a third condition there, to pay an annuity. So for example, it might be a trust which will pay an income of a regular amount to a person for their life. And typically that would be something like a pension, but it can be wider than that. And finally, if you have a lease for someone's life or for a term which is defined by reference to a person's death, that is also a deemed trust. So, yeah, some things are quite obviously trusts. Some things aren't quite so obviously trusts. But essentially it's any gift by which property is held for another person. And we then have the definition of a settlor, which is a person who creates a trust or who adds any property to a trust. Now that's a very important definition because depending upon who the settlor is, that will mean that the charge within the trust is greater or lesser. And it can, in some circumstances, define a person who is liable to pay an inheritance tax liability if the trustees don't pay it. So, how are trusts used? Well, they're used in all sorts of different situations. These are the main ones. The protection of minors or vulnerable persons. So, again, it might be to say someone puts property in trust for a child until they reach age 25 when they become entitled to it. Giving it to them immediately might cause some problems. Provision of future benefits or to cover future liabilities. So for example, there may be a future liability such as inheritance tax which needs to be paid perhaps in 7 years' time, and putting funds in trust to meet that obligation or that liability is a good way of ensuring that the funds aren't spent in the meantime. Then we have a situation where someone may wish to give rights to a person without giving them the assets themselves. So they may give a right of occupation in a house rather than giving them the house itself, which would otherwise enable them to sell the house. Then there are other things which we're not going to talk about in great detail, but incentivizing employees. There are such things as employee benefit trusts which carry all sorts of tax reliefs and exemptions, but essentially they are giving rights or a right to be considered to an employee to receive shares or cash in the future, perhaps on hitting certain targets. Then we have pensions. All pensions are set up as trust funds for various reasons. And then there is privacy of ownership. So quite often you have a situation whereby someone will put shares in a private company into a trust, not necessarily for tax reasons, but because they want to keep the identity of the ownership of those shares a secret in some way. Now there are all sorts of rules which restrict that ability to do that, But quite often that is done, and it may be a house, it may be shares, it may be other things. But again, it's outside the scope of this webinar, but it's something to bear in mind. So, types of trust for inheritance tax purposes. Now, there was a real sea change on the 22nd of March 2006, where effectively the whole definition of a trust and the different categorisation of trusts was changed. But it's important to consider what happened before that date, because some of those trusts will continue. So the first type of trust then was what was called a relevant property trust, which was also more commonly called a discretionary trust. Now, if you set up a discretionary trust, there was an immediate inheritance tax charge on transferring funds in. We'll talk about this later, because this is relevant to current trusts as well as those created before March 2006. But essentially, these were discretionary trusts which gave no one any rights. So the trustees had complete discretion over when they paid out income, when they paid out capital, and to whom they paid out income, and to whom they paid out capital, so long as the persons who received a benefit were defined in the trust deed or trust document as a beneficiary. Then the second class of trusts before March 2006 was an interest in possession trust. Now, that sort of trust effectively gave someone the right to receive something immediately. So it was either a right of occupation or it was a right to receive income of some nature. When that sort of trust was set up, it was treated in the same way as a gift to an individual, and the individual who was the beneficiary of the trust was treated for inheritance tax purposes as if they effectively owned the trust assets, even though they didn't in reality. Then there was an accumulation and maintenance trust, so an A&M trust. Now, that was a bit of a hybrid. It was a trust which required that a child became entitled to either the income or the capital of the trust fund on or before reaching the age of 25. Now, it was effectively, before the child became entitled to that right to income or right to capital, it was effectively a discretionary trust or a relevant property trust, and it stayed that way even after a child became entitled to receive income. So it didn't become an interest in possession trust at that time. So that sort of trust was a favoured trust because it didn't attract inheritance tax liabilities, which relevant property trusts normally attract. And finally, there was a bare trust. Now, a bare trust isn't really a trust at all. It's called a trust, but it's effectively ownership by the beneficial owner. And again, when that sort of trust was created, it was also treated in the same way as a gift to the individual, because the individual was the true owner of the property. So that was all changed in 2006. And from that date, some of the definitions remained similar, but actually the types of trust changed quite drastically. So firstly, we had a relevant property trust. Now, that now is much wider than it ever was, because it includes trusts which do give certain beneficiaries rights. But we'll come back to that, because effectively a relevant property trust is a trust which doesn't fall within any of the other categories. So the other categories are a qualifying interest in possession. Now, you'll remember that an interest in possession was a trust which gave immediate rights to income to a beneficiary. Now, any trust which was created after the 22nd of March 2006, which gives those immediate rights, is not going to be a qualifying interest in possession trust unless it satisfies certain conditions. So many trusts that were interest in possession trusts will now be relevant property trusts. And I'll come onto that in a second with a bit more information and a bit more detail. So then we have bereaved minors trusts. So they're trusts for certain types of children. Then we have a qualifying accumulation and maintenance trust, which is similar to but not the same as the old style accumulation and maintenance trust. An 18 to 25 trust, which is also a sort of accumulation and maintenance trust. And then we again have a bare trust, which again is not really a trust at all, but I mention it for completeness. So just looking at that list of new style trusts from 22nd March 2006, so any trusts that are created after that date, the first one is the qualifying interest in possession trust. So the first thing to note is, what does an interest in possession mean? Well, generally an interest in possession means, and it's defined by case law, the case of IRC and Pearson, is where a person has an immediate right to the immediate enjoyment of trust property, so which is normally the right to receive income or the right to occupy property. So there are four types of qualifying interest in possession trust which are listed here. The first one is an immediate post-death interest. So that is an interest in possession which is created on a person's death, by which a person immediately becomes entitled to the income or the right to occupy property within a trust fund. We then have the second category, which is a trust which was created before the 22nd of March 2006 and which continues unchanged. So if someone had the right to income in an old style trust and they still have that right to income, that will still be a qualifying interest in possession trust. Thirdly, we have a disabled person's interest. Now these are quite complicated because they can be either discretionary trusts which give no one any rights to anything, or they can be trusts which give a beneficiary the right to receive the income. But they are treated in both cases as if the beneficiary had an interest in possession. So a disabled person's trust is effectively a trust for a disabled person, which is simple, but then we have to look at what disabled person means. Now that can be one of two things. Firstly, it can be a person who is incapable of managing their own affairs, and that's defined in the Mental Health Act of 1983. So a trust for that sort of person is a disabled person's trust. Or alternatively, if the beneficiary is in receipt of certain types of benefits, the trust will also automatically qualify as a disabled person's trust, subject to the terms of the trust also being satisfied. Now those benefits are personal independence payments, disabled living allowance, attendance allowance, and in some cases they have to be received at a certain level, so this has to be a certain level of qualification. And there was a change in April 2014 which changed the level at which some of those benefits had to be received before a person became a disabled person for the purposes of this legislation. Now, not only do you have to have a disabled person, you either have to have a situation whereby the disabled person is entitled to the income, or otherwise no one is entitled to the income. And secondly, during the lifetime of the disabled person, any capital that is applied from the trust or any income that is applied from the trust can only be applied for the benefit of that disabled person. So that's a disabled person's trust. Finally, we have a thing called a transitional serial interest. Now, that is really where you have a succeeding interest in possession from a previous interest in possession. So which would say Mr. A has a right to receive the income for his life or until terminated earlier, and when that happens, Mr. B then becomes entitled to the income. Now in that example, Mr. B's interest will be a transitional serial interest if Mr. A's interest in possession existed before the 22nd of March 2006 and it terminated sometime between the 22nd of March 2006 and the 5th of October 2008, at which time Mr. B's succeeding interest in possession began. So there's a relatively short time frame, but there is an alternative which lasts a lot longer, which is that you must firstly still have an interest in possession which existed on the 22nd of March 2006 and which then ended on the death of the life tenant at any time after the 5th of October 2008. And in that case, as long as the succeeding interest in possession is held by the spouse of the life tenant, the original life tenant, that will then be a transitional serial interest. So in that latter case, it has to be the death of the life tenant, and it must then pass to the spouse of the life tenant. So if we have a qualifying interest in possession, so that is all of those things in the last four bullet points on the previous slide, then there are certain events which give rise to inheritance tax. The firstly is the creation of that interest in possession. And if that's on death, it's treated in the normal way. So inheritance tax, if the value of the estate exceeds the nil rate band of inheritance tax. But if the interest in possession is an immediate post-death interest, and the immediate post-death interest is held by the spouse, then there will be an exemption from inheritance tax, as if the property was left outright to him or to her. Then we have the death of the life tenant. So if someone's entitled to income for life under a qualifying interest in possession and they die, they are treated as if they had owned those assets personally, and the value of those assets will be aggregated with their own personal funds for the purposes of calculating inheritance tax. There will then be an apportionment of how much tax is paid by the trustees and how much is paid by the estate. Then if the interest in possession ends during the life tenant's lifetime, that will either be a chargeable lifetime transfer if on the end of the life tenant's interest the trust fund passes on relevant property trusts. So it will be treated as if the life tenant had made the gift to the trust. Or it will be a potentially exempt transfer if the trust fund vests absolutely in another person, or if it passes into another qualifying interest in possession, such as a disabled person's interest. So then we have another specific type of trust, which is a bereaved minors trust. Now this is quite specific. It must be created on the death of a parent. So the bereaved minor must be the deceased's child. And that can be created under a will, under the intestacy rules, or it can be compensation under the Criminal Injuries Compensation Fund. But it's generally under a will. And the bereaved minor must become entitled to capital at an age on or before age 18. So it's quite restrictive, and people tend to avoid these sorts of trusts in wills purely because they are concerned about the beneficiary becoming entitled at an age when they may not be ready to receive a large amount of money. So the inheritance tax events which arise in this case are on creation. So if it's in a will, if the nil rate band is exceeded, there will be an inheritance tax liability at 40% on the excess. But there are certain beneficial areas of such trusts, one of which is that there will be no inheritance tax when the child reaches the age of entitlement, so let's say 18. And if the child dies before 18 or before the age of entitlement, there'll be no inheritance tax liability. And if the trustees exercise the powers to advance the trust fund to the child at an age earlier than 18, there will also be no inheritance tax charge at that time. So we then have a qualifying A&M trust. I won't say too much about this because you can't create a new qualifying accumulation and maintenance trust. It had to be created before the 22nd of March 2006. But essentially, it must have required similar to the Bereaved Miners Trust, that the trust funds vested in a miner on reaching age 18. Now, these trusts could have been created not necessarily by the parent. They could have been created by a grandparent, by an aunt or uncle, or by anybody else. And they didn't have to be created on death. They could have been created during lifetime or on death. So just as a brief summary of the inheritance tax events, none when the child reaches the age of entitlement. So if it said that the child reaches 25 and becomes entitled to the capital, there would be no inheritance tax event at that time. If it said, for example, that the child was to become entitled to income on reaching 18 and capital at 25, then again, there will be no inheritance tax event on the child attaining the interest in possession. However, there is a rule that says that if that sort of trust lasts for more than 25 years and there is no common grandparent of all of the beneficiaries, there will on that 25th year anniversary be an inheritance tax charge, which is currently at 21%. So then we have an 18 to 25 trust. So this is similar to an accumulation and maintenance trust, except that it is very much more restricted. Again, it must be created on the death of a parent, or it can be created before 22nd of March 2006 by any person during lifetime or on their death. But again, there must be this capital entitlement before or on the child reaching age 25. So this can give rise to complications, because those tests look relatively straightforward. So entitlement to capital at 25 must be created now by a deceased parent. But some of these trusts can inadvertently become qualifying interest in possession trusts, or be qualifying interest in possession trusts from outset. For example, if a parent in his or her will leaves funds in trust for a child on reaching 25, but with a right to receive income at 18, and the child is age 20 when the parent dies, they will immediately have become entitled to a right to the income. So it will be a qualifying interest in possession by virtue of being an immediate post-death interest. So the inheritance tax events for an 18 to 25 trust will be on creation. So if it's in the will, it will be treated in the same way as any legacy. If it was created during lifetime, it would have been before the 22nd of March 2006, so we don't have to worry about that. So there are really, looking at the trust itself, two different times to look at it. The first time is when the beneficiary is before the age of 18 or at the age of 18, and at that time it's treated as in the same way as a bereaved miner's trust. So there'll be no inheritance tax on entitlement if they become entitled at age 18 or before, and no inheritance tax on the death of the miner. On the other hand, once a child has reached the age of 18, there will then become an inheritance tax liability on reaching the age of entitlement. And if the funds are advanced to the child after 18, but before the age of entitlement, there will also then be an inheritance tax event. Just finally, on the types of trust, a bare trust, as I say, is simply a nominee arrangement whereby a person or persons are holding as bare trustees or nominees for the true beneficial owner. Now, where you have a bare trust for a child who, for example, may be aged 15, and persons are holding property for that child because that child may not be old enough to have something registered in their names or to control or vote on something, that sort of trust has certain statutory rules applying to it. So, for example, Section 31 of the Trustee Act provides that income which arises before a child reaches age 18 can be accumulated at the discretion of the trustees. But once a child becomes 18, they become entitled as of right to the income, unless the trust says otherwise. So that would make you think that a bare trust for a child, where they aren't entitled as of right to the income, but it can be applied at the discretion of the trustees or accumulated, you would think that would be a relevant property trust. But it isn't. It's excepted from that rule because strictly and legally the trust has to hold the income and the accumulated income for the benefit of the child as it arises, and it's just an administrative provision by which the trustees can accumulate it. So inheritance tax events in that case are death of a beneficiary because they are the true owner of the property, or if the beneficial interest ends during the beneficiary's lifetime, which is effectively just a gift for the same reason. So a potentially exempt transfer if it's to another person, or if it's then transferred into a trust, it could be a chargeable lifetime transfer if it's a relevant property trust, or a potentially exempt transfer if it's a qualifying interest in possession trust. So that brings us on to relevant property trusts, which are every other type of trust. So anything that's not a qualifying interest in possession trust, anything that's not a bereaved minors trust, anything that isn't a qualifying A&M trust, or an 18 to 25 trust, or a bare trust. And there are certain other trusts, such as charitable trusts or pensions, which are governed by their own tax code or by their own set of exemptions, and we're not considering those here. So, how is a relevant property trust taxed? There are four occasions of charge. Firstly is when they are created, and that effectively is when a gift is made to a relevant property trust. Now, that is an immediate chargeable transfer. So if the value of the transfer, taking into account other chargeable transfers made by the settlor in the previous 7 years, if that total exceeds the settlor's nil rate band of inheritance tax, which is currently £325,000, then the surplus will be subject to inheritance tax at 20%. So there's a 20% upfront charge. And the settlor can pay that, or the trustees can pay that. And that's quite important because it changes the amount of tax, because if the settlor pays the tax, his gift is slightly larger. So the gift has to be grossed up in order to work out the inheritance tax. And if the settlor does pay the tax, that also can have an effect on the later charges within the trust. So that's creation. So the tax charge then. The next event would be if there is a transfer out by the trustees. So the trustees will either have discretion to pay out within the first 10 years or later. And these trusts normally last for the maximum period of time permitted by law, which is 125 years, but they can be, by definition, a shorter period of time. So if the trustees pay out within the first 10 years, the amount which is paid out, that's the amount which ceases to be relevant property, is then subject to inheritance tax. And I'll just come on to a bit more detail in a few moments. There is then a 10-yearly anniversary charge. So every 10 years, there is a charge to inheritance tax on the value of the funds which are then in the trust. And then there is a separate set of charging rules for transfers out of the trust or property ceasing to be relevant property at any time after the first 10-year anniversary or after subsequent 10-year anniversaries. So, looking at exit charges or transfers out within the first 10 years, the charge is applied to any value which ceases to be relevant property. As I say, that's normally when the trustees pay trust funds out So they become the absolute property of the beneficiary. But it can also be the case where a different set of trust rules apply, so it becomes a different type of trust. So if the trust becomes a disabled property, a disabled person's trust, that would be an occasion when there would be an exit charge. So in looking at the tax charge, you have to really follow a set of three rules. Firstly, you have to work out what the hypothetical transfer is. So this is an imagined transfer, which you then use to work out the effective rate of tax. And once you have the effective rate of tax, you adjust it to produce a real rate of tax. And that real rate of tax is then applied to the property which ceases to become relevant property. So the hypothetical transfer, which is the first thing we need to find, is essentially the value of the property when it first went into the trust. So you look at the initial value. Then you have to look at the value of any related settlements created by the same settlor. So that's settlements created by the same settlor on the same date. So you look at the value of the property which went into those related settlements at the time when it went in. You then need to look at a new principle, which is called a same-day addition. This was brought in 2015 when these sorts of trusts, the taxation was changed. So you look at same-day additions. So if property was transferred into this trust on the same day that property was transferred into another trust, you need to look at the value of the other trust when that trust was created, plus the value of the addition into the current trust. And then you look at all other additions to this trust, and that gives you the hypothetical transfer. So that's the figure on which we're going to calculate an initial imaginary inheritance tax charge, which will give us an effective rate of tax. So once you've looked at all those things, you then calculate the inheritance tax. And you calculate the inheritance tax by looking at the nil rate band, which is the nil rate band which is in effect for a natural person at that date, but you knock off any chargeable transfers that were made by the settlor in the 7 years before he or she created the trust. And you always keep this 7-year running total of gifts against future transfers and future events within the trust. So let's say, just as a very simple example, the value of the trust fund when it went in was £250,000. The settlor had made potentially exempt transfers of £50,000 2 years before he created this trust. And then there's a transfer out of the trust of all of the trust fund, which by then is £350,000, 5 years later. So in that example, the £350,000 that's ceasing to be relevant property is what's going to be charged, but we need to look at the hypothetical transfer in working out the rate which is applied to that £350,000. The hypothetical transfer is the £250,000 which went into the trust at the beginning, and then we look at that and we consider the tax that's payable on that. So we knock off firstly the nil rate band of inheritance tax. Well, that's going to completely wipe it out. So the transferor or the settlor's previous history of gifts is irrelevant in that case. But if the value of the trust had been larger, they would have wiped out a part of the nil rate band. Now, once we have the nil rate band established, any excess over that is charged at 20%. So let's use a different example. Let's say the value of the initial value of the fund was £400,000, and the settlor made chargeable transfers of £300,000 in the 7 years before he set the trust up. So we're then looking at an initial value of £400,000. 300 of the nil rate band has already been used, so we've got 25,000 of it left. And so of that initial value of 400,000, 375,000 is chargeable. Now that's chargeable at the lifetime rate of 20%, not 40%, so it's half the usual rate. So once we have that figure, we then work out the tax at 20%, and we apply that figure for the tax as a percentage of the hypothetical value. So it's a percentage of the 400,000 in my example. And that gives you an effective rate, or an average rate. So that's the effective rate. We then need to move down to the adjustment of the effective rate, and that's really looking at how long has this property been in the trust. So how many complete quarters, that's periods of 3 months, has this property been in the trust? And we look at it as a percentage of what it would have been had it been in there for the full 10 years. So if it's been in there for 1 year, that's 4 quarters, and we look at that as 4 quarters out of a potential 40 quarters, which is 10 years. So it's 1/10. So we take the effective rate, we multiply it by 1/10, and then we multiply it by 30%. And it's always multiplied by 30%, but as well as being multiplied by a figure to give you the proportionate charge. So once you then have that rate, the effective rate times 30% times the number of quarters divided by 40, you then have the actual rate. When you have the actual rate, you apply that to the value of the property, which ceases to be relevant property. So it's a long drawn out computation, and you just have to follow the methodology carefully each time. Now there is a similar set of rules every 10 years. So every 10 years you have to go through the same process of working out the hypothetical value, the hypothetical transfer. Then you work out the effective rate by looking at that hypothetical transfer, and then you have to adjust that effective rate. So in this case, the hypothetical transfer is the value of the relevant property within the trust at the 10th anniversary. Now I've mentioned there in the slide that there were some changes on the 18th of November 2015, and this applies also to the exit charges in the first 10 years. Before the 18th of November 2015, you looked at all property, whether it was relevant property or not. But now you only consider relevant property when considering the hypothetical transfer. So you look at the hypothetical, look at the value of the fund at the 10th anniversary. You look at the value of related settlements, settlements set up on the same date by the same settlor. Look at the value when they were set up. You look at same day additions, so additions to this trust and other trusts on the same date, in which case you look at the initial value of the other trust, and you look at the value of the additions to this trust as a result of those same day additions, and you look at the value of additions to this trust as a result of any other additions. So once you have your hypothetical transfer, you then again calculate the effective rate of tax by knocking off the nil rate band, and as before, the nil rate band will be reduced by any chargeable transfers made by the settlor in the 7 years before he created this trust. They may have been potentially exempt transfers when he made them, but if he died within 7 years afterwards, they would have become chargeable transfers. So you need to be very careful in looking at these transfers, because sometimes even after the trust was created, there's a retrospective look at gifts made by the settlor before the trust was created, which were pets at the time and may have become chargeable lifetime transfers since. So you look at the hypothetical transfer, knock off the nil rate band of inheritance tax as reduced by the settlor's history of gifts, and you also reduce the nil rate band by any transfers out of the trust on the occasion of property ceasing to be relevant property trusts, relevant property within the previous 10 years. Again, the excess is then charged at a rate of 20% to give you the effective rate, and that effective rate is then adjusted. Firstly, you apply the 30% rate, so it's always 30% times 20%, which gives you a 6%. and then you adjust it again because some of the property which is in the trust at the 10th anniversary may not have been relevant property for the entire 10 years. So you look at the number of complete quarters for which it was relevant property out of the potential 40 quarters and you apply that fraction again. So again, if it was relevant property for 1 year, that's 4 quarters out of a potential 40, 4/40, 1/10. So again, you're reducing it by a proportion of a tenth. So effectively, what this means is, looking at it in the round, if a trust is created with funds that are worth less than the nil rate band, and the nil rate band doesn't then subsequently change, and if the settlor hadn't used any of his or her nil rate band in the 7 years before setting up the trust, it means that you will never have an inheritance tax charge if property is transferred out of the trust within the first 10 years. You may have a 10-year anniversary charge because the value of the property has increased, and so therefore there's an opportunity to look at the trust after 9 years or 9.5 years and consider whether to bring the trust to an end by transferring the relevant property to one of the beneficiaries. And then we have the final category of inheritance tax charges on payments out of the trust to a beneficiary or property ceasing to be relevant property for another reason after the first 10-year anniversary charge. Now, again, strictly, you need to go through the process of working out the hypothetical transfer, the effective rate, and then adjusting it, and then applying that to the property which ceases to be relevant property. But the simple way of looking at it is to look back at the last 10-year anniversary, look at the actual rate of tax which was applied, and then adjust that rate for the number of complete quarters that have expired since that last 10-year anniversary. And again, you express that as a percentage of 40 quarters. That is the next 10-year time span. So that's relatively straightforward. It becomes a little bit more complicated if the nil rate band has changed since the last 10-year anniversary charge, or if the rates of inheritance tax have changed since the last 10-year anniversary charge. And if that's the case, you then have to recalculate the 10-yearly charge to work out the actual rate of tax. And then again, you apply that rate of tax as adjusted to the value of the property which ceases to be relevant property, taking into account the number of quarters that have expired. So finally, just a word about settlor interested trusts. There are specific rules relating to income tax and capital gains tax, which are applied to settlors who benefit from trusts which they create, but that's beyond the scope of this talk. But as far as inheritance tax is concerned, in general terms, if a settlor creates a trust and benefits from it, he's made a gift of the reservation of benefit. So therefore, the value of the property remains within his or her estate for inheritance tax purposes. That doesn't necessarily mean that there isn't a charge in the trust as well. There can be a charge in both. But there are generally double taxation regulations which mean that one tax charge can be offset against the other and there's not a double tax charge. But there can still, in some cases, be a double tax charge. So generally, again, talking in general terms, if a settlor creates a trust and excludes himself or herself as a beneficiary, but includes his or her spouse or civil partner as a beneficiary, that is generally not a reservation of benefit. But HMRC can apply the reservation of benefit rules if the settlor is able to benefit from the gift which is made into the trust for the benefit of the spouse. So some caution is required in looking at the rules. Where a settlor does create a trust, which creates a qualifying interest in possession for his spouse, now, under the old rules, that was very simple because it just gave the spouse a right to receive the income. But it's not quite as easy as that post 22nd of March 2006. So now it has to be a disabled person's interest, effectively. But where that's done, where a settlor creates a trust which gives his or her spouse a qualifying interest in possession, the spouse is not treated as having made the gift until the spouse dies or until his or her interest in possession ceases. So there's a delay in the date on which the transfer is made for the purposes of the reservation of benefit rules. Finally, there's a concept called reverter to settlor trusts, which again now are not going to be quite so common post 22nd March 2006. Reverter to settlor trust was, simply put, a trust which gave someone an interest in possession, and on the end of that interest in possession, the property reverted to the settlor or to the settlor's spouse. Now, although in general terms, where you create an interest in possession or a qualifying interest in possession, the value of the trust assets are treated as having been owned by the life tenant, so there's an inheritance tax liability when it comes to an end, that is not the case in a reverter to settlor trust. There is no inheritance tax charge when the property reverts back to the settlor. So the settlor has what you call a remainder interest or a residual interest. So there's that exemption. But what it does mean is that the value of the funds are always within the estate of the settlor, regardless of the fact that someone else has an interest in possession or a qualifying interest in possession in them. It's a bit more complicated than that, but that's the general rule. So really, I think that's all that I can say about the new rules. In some ways, quite complicated, but if you've been looking at trusts for a number of years, it's sometimes quite difficult to get your mind around the new rules, because I was working with trusts for 20 years before the 2006 rules came into play, and it's still sometimes quite difficult to get your mind around the fact that an interest in possession isn't treated as the property of the life tenant. So that's all I've got to say on the subject. The following slides cover some forthcoming webinars that LexisNexis are putting on. And just a final reminder, and I'll read this because that's in fairly small type. This webinar is designed to help solicitors meet requirements A2, that's maintain competence and legal knowledge, and A4, which is to draw on detailed knowledge and understanding of the SRA's Statement of Solicitor Competence. You may also use the quiz, which can be accessed via the Take a Quiz link on the webinar details page, to reinforce your understanding of the webinar content. Now, you have two chances of successfully completing the quiz, which should hopefully be relatively straightforward. And if you have any feedback on the whole of the webinar, please submit that via the survey screen. This webinar will be archived immediately and will be available on demand for a period of 12 months. And a transcript of the webinar can be made available on request. Thank you.